Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right, celebrating America was rooted in the late 19th century when labor activists pushed for a federal holiday to recognize the many contributions workers had made to America's strength, prosperity, and well-being. And when I think of America's workers, I always think of my pal, Mike Rowe, and his foundation celebrating its 16th anniversary. Mike Rowe Works. He's the host of the rebooted Discovery Channel series, Dirty Jobs, host of the podcast, The Way I Heard It, voice of The Deadliest Catch. He hosts How America Works on Fox Business. He put out a film earlier this summer called Something to Stand For. Did I leave anything out, Mike?
Yeah, I wrote a book, Dave. I'm pretty excited about that. My mom's fourth book is coming out.
No way.
Let's see. Can you believe that? This woman, Peggy Rowe, her first bestseller hit the stands when she was 80. Wow. She had written every day for 60 years, and she's since written three more books. And, yeah, you know, since it's Labor Day, I always talk about my granddad and my dad and the hundreds of people I've worked with on all these shows and stuff, and that's great. But it's so ironic for me because in terms of real work ethic, my mom was right under my nose for all those years, writing every single day for 60 years without a book deal. And, I never really thought much about it until all of a sudden she got published. And I thought, well, there you go, man. If you want to talk about persistence, she's it.
Took six decades to get to that point. But, yeah, absolutely loved her last book, too. That's great. What's the new book called?
It's called Oh, No, Not the Home, Observations and Confessions of a Grandmother in Transition.
I love it. I love that. Oh, wow. And when does that come out, Mike?
It'll be out in early October, October 15th, I think. And I swear to God, if anybody else, I mean, if you were a publisher and somebody came and said, hey, I want to pitch you a series of true short stories about life in a retirement community, you'd be like, let me find the nearest roof to dive off.
Not at all. She's a great, she tells great stories like you do.
They're funny and they're warm and they're real. You know, there are more people alive today, I think, in their 90s than there ever have been. And, you know, it's not a book necessarily for elderly people. It's a book for everybody. But who knew that that cohort could be so damn entertaining?
Let me tell you something. I was just in L.A. actually last week and for Bob Newhart's memorial, and Dick Van Dyke was there, who's 98 and a half. And shaking hands and introducing himself to people, he said he needs to find new friends because all his friends are dead. So here's the guy at 98. He keeps moving, this guy.
I promise not to burn up more than 20 seconds, but I met Dick Van Dyke in a stairwell 7 years ago when I was inducted into the Barbershop Harmony Society Hall of Fame.
Of course he was there.
And we sang songs together in the stairwell.
God. Yeah, he loves that stuff. He loves the a cappella stuff that he does. That was like his 15th act that he did later in life. I know that's how you got, that's kind of how like you started things like back then, because you have an incredible voice. Yeah.
Well, I didn't know what to do, you know, when I realized that the handy gene was recessive and that I wasn't going to follow in my granddad's footsteps. You know, a man who literally built a house I was born in without a blueprint.
Wow.
I was so sure I was going to be the guy he was. But, you know, it didn't work out, and he told me to get a different toolbox. You could be a tradesman, he said. Just get a different toolbox. So that was the beginning of it. I learned how to sing. I learned how to write. I learned how to narrate. I learned how to act, sort of. And then, you know, way leads on the way. And the next thing you know, you're hosting a show 35 years later about your grandfather.
Yeah. Yeah. How cool is that, though? Yeah.
That's great.
Talk to me just a little bit before we dive into the labor statistics, which I want to talk to you about, is the film you put out earlier this summer called Something to Stand For. I'm hoping that's going to be streaming at some point soon.
It will. I'm right on the verge of figuring out how to make that deal. You know, it's been an education. I never made a movie before, but the Fathom Group came, these former theater owners who have kind of a new way of developing occasion-driven content. You know, they did a big project with Andrea Bocelli for Christmas last year, and they wanted to do something around Independence Day. So they called me and they said, you know, we like these short stories you've written and adapted for TV. What if we pick 9 really patriotic ones and stitch them together for some sort of 4th of July spectacular? I thought about it for about 2 seconds and said, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
So Something to Stand For was out for about 2 weeks as planned over the 4th of July. And it was just a collection of 9 short stories told in the style of Paul Harvey's old The Rest of the Story. So they're mysteries, you know, a chance to learn something you didn't know about somebody you do. Except in this case, they were all about our founding fathers and pivotal people and the growth of the country. Anyway, it was great. People seemed to like it. In fact, this is such a thing to tell you, but if you go on Rotten Tomatoes right now, it's on the hot list with a 98% customer enthusiasm rate or whatever that thing
is. All right, yeah.
So yeah, it worked out. It was great.
I love it. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this recent headline. It's the U.S. job growth during much of the past year was significantly weaker than initially estimated, according to new data. The Bureau of Labor Statistics annual benchmark review suggests that there were 818,000 fewer jobs this year than were initially reported, and that certainly serves as a critical gauge of the overall health and activity of the U.S. job market based on what's been touted.
Well, when that statistic came out a week or so ago, I was gobsmacked by it. But in the same token, things started to make a lot of sense. I've been talking for the last couple of years about the fact that 7.5 million able-bodied men in the prime of their working life are not only not working, they're affirmatively not looking for work.
Right.
And I've been talking about the fact that we've got roughly 9 million open positions right now that companies are struggling to fill, jobs that by and large don't require a 4-year degree, but rather the training and the certification that my foundation focuses on. And then finally, roughly 5 million people were out there in the sort of the unemployed world. So if you just look at all these stats, they don't make any sense. Like, there's a ton of opportunity, but there's nobody that's either trained or enthused about the opportunities. And it just seemed like such a colossal gap. But this statistic that you're mentioning actually reinforces it. If you think about it, it's like, well, of course they didn't create, you know, an extra 818,000 jobs. That, I mean, there are 9 million that are currently sitting there that aren't filled.
Right.
Like, it just, like, if you really look at the broad numbers, it just, none of the data made any sense leading up to it, unless these big, broad numbers were wrong, and they're not. There really are 7 million able-bodied men sitting on their hands right now, and there really are 9 million open jobs that people aren't enthused about. And that's just the way it's been since the pandemic, and it's getting worse. And, you know, my foundation is not, we're pushing the boulder up the hill, and we're seeing some progress in some areas. But it's a serious situation, Dave. Our workforce is wildly out of balance, and we just can't have a healthy economy with that many jobs unfilled and that many people affirmatively not working who otherwise could.
Well, part of it is, as you said, it's people who left the workforce during and after the pandemic, but this is also a little bit where the skills gap also plays a role. And I just read also that more Americans are looking for jobs and they're worried they're going to lose their job in the next 4 months because of recession issues and everything else. So you talk about maybe people are mismatched for jobs, but the skills gap does absolutely play a role.
The skills gap is real, but so too is the will gap. And, you know, there's not much to say about that that's flattering, but it has to do with stigmas and stereotypes and myths and misperceptions, and people have it into their heads that welding is the thing you do if you can't do anything else, you know, or if you're not cut out for a four-year degree or something. My foundation has trained over 2,000 men and women. Probably a third of them are welders, and most are making an excess of six figures. People just don't understand where the opportunities actually are. So, you know, changing hearts and minds is certainly part of the problem. But, yeah, fundamentally, we got a math problem. You know, there for every five tradespeople who have been leaving the workforce over the last decade, two have replaced them. It's like that year after year. Five leave, two come in. And the math is just not sustainable at all. And so I'm not an alarmist. You know, fundamentally, I'm still bullish and optimistic on things. But somebody needs to ring the alarm bell really hard. And Labor Day is a good day to do it because it's not just a celebration of labor. I mean, I know it is historically, but it ought to also be a rumination on work.
Wake up call.
And on the definition of a good job, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we have to have that conversation because right now we're upside down.
Well, enrollment into trade schools has risen 16%, highest it's been since 2018. There was also a 23% in students seeking construction jobs after high school. And I believe you've talked about this before, that Generation Z could be the next tool belt generation, and emphasizing that, you know, they're going to choose a blue collar career, which can be very, very lucrative over bankruptcy from student loans, quite frankly.
Mm. Well, they're going to have to because there's nobody else. I mean, everybody else is aged out. And there's lots of spots. There's lots of bright spots. You know, I think the thing we've got to be mindful of is not to paint with too broad a brush. Gen Z is a lot of people. Gen X is a lot of people. Millennials are a lot of people.
Yeah.
The boomers, God help us, we're a lot of people. But we're all different, you know, and there is a cohort within Gen Z that has absolutely gotten the memo. They've looked at the price of a four-year ticket, and they've looked at the upside of vocational training. They did the math, and they like it. And, you know, my job in MicroWorks is to help tell their stories. Because those are real empowering stories. They're stories of success. They're stories of people who prospered as a direct result of taking the alternative route before your degree. And that's the only way. I mean, I can tell a story anecdotally, but I can only be so persuasive. You know, Gen Z needs to hear from other Gen Zers who have figured it out. And we're going to spend a lot of time this year, you know, creating a platform for those guys. We just have to tell better stories. And look, I'll tell you this, never before has the Ivy League made my job easier than in this last year.
Well, and then go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, it's just every time you pick up the newspaper, it's either rising tuitions or it's a protest or it's a dean saying something so inconceivably stupid that you can't even defend it. It's plagiarism. You know, it's Harvard with a $52 billion endowment who are now forgiving, with the help of the federal government, forgiving the debts of some of their graduates, while the plumbers and steam fitters and welders and pipe fitters who we've helped train are being asked to foot the bill for that. It's outrageous, and people are starting to get that memo as well. And I can't think of a better day than Labor Day to to tell that story.
Your MicroWorks Foundation scholarships that surround programs that support the trades, and we've been talking about this for 10 years, that there used to be shop classes in high school, and these are great paying jobs, and those shop classes are gone, but you always put your money where your mouth is, and you are constantly giving scholarships to train people for these trades that so desperately need help.
Thanks. Yeah, we have a work ethic scholarship program. It's been around about 10 years. The foundation's been around since Labor Day 2008. But the scholarships serve a couple of purposes. The first and most obvious one is it pays for the training for the next generation of skilled workers, and that's important. It's not cheap. It's a lot more affordable than most four-year degrees, but you're talking about heavy equipment operators and steam fitters and pipe fitters, lots of jobs in the energy field, lots of jobs in construction. And so we do what we can to help that out. But as the foundation's grown and as more and more people have applied, I've been able to raise more money. So we give away a couple million dollars every year. In fact, I think we're the most robust trade school scholarship program in the country.
Amazing.
And that was never the goal. I mean, it's a happy symptom. I'll take it. But the reason it's really beneficial now is because, to my earlier point, I'm now able to look back and talk to people who we assisted 5, 6, 7 years ago and ask them how it's going. And those stories, Dave, are actually pretty inspirational. You know, when you talk to a guy like I did just a couple weeks ago, a welder who we gave probably $8,000 to, well, he went on to weld, and then he got real good, and then he was doing some underwater welding, made a lot of money overseas, saved it up, came home, bought a van, hired a couple of buddies, a plumber and an electrician, bought another van, got an HVAC guy, another plumber, another electrician. Now, guy has 4 vans today, a mechanical contracting company, 9 employees. He's doing $3 million a year. And so that's a pretty straight line from a welding certification to a small business. And, you know, that story gets lost on Labor Day because we have a tendency to think only about this day in terms of employers and employees and union and non-union and all of these inherently divisive kinds of delineations that we make in the wide world of work. But again, right in front of us are example after example of people who have prospered as a result of learning a skill and then brought a measure of entrepreneurship into the equation and prospered as a result. And those stories are every bit as relevant on a day like this than the ones the UAW might tell you.
Well, and that's at microworks.org, and you can learn a lot more about Mike's organization. But this is about investment in people. And that is, and I've always believed that that's how you create jobs, is you invest in people, you train them, you allow them to grow, then they're going to go to do the same thing with other people and hire and build a business.
It's a bit like the advice you get, you know, from the flight attendant as you're taking off. You know, if the oxygen masks fall, then put yours on first. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to be of much use to the people on either side of you. You have to invest in yourself first. You have to, you know, take the measure of the market. If you're an 18, 19-year-old person trying to figure out what to do with the rest of your life, you have to understand what that investment really and truly is. You know, we have a way of using that word a lot, at least higher ed does. You know, oh, it's not an education, Dave. It's an investment in your future. And therefore, anybody who would speak poorly about the wisdom of that investment, you know, must be selling something. But of course, if you're going to invest in a 4-year degree, you have to be free to say, well, how much does it actually cost? And what precisely are the terms of the repayment? And how long is it going to take me? Should I be so lucky to find work in my chosen field to take care of that debt. And, you know, sometimes I worry that when we talk about that level of education as an investment, we encourage people to ignore the brute realities of the servitude that comes along with that kind of indenture.
Yeah.
It's just heartbreaking to me. $1.7 trillion are still on the books, and we're still arguing about, you know, whether or not college is the best path for the most people. How could it be at that price? How could it be?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's my message, ma'am. We have to, on this day and on every day, look around and see the opportunities for what they are and encourage people to put everything on the table before they slip into this hopeless miasma of debt while we've got 9 million open jobs around us.
Before I let you go, we've been talking about this for the last few years, and it seems like the same story over and over, but you always talk about the American work ethic, and there are a quarter of U.S. companies will require its workers to show up at the office more next year in 2025. And we have been out of this pandemic for quite some time, and you know, I know there's certain jobs, maybe you are more productive at home, and I want to give that to those people, but I also think the productivity, the camaraderie, the bonding that you do at work, the collaboration is missing in a lot of this, but these return-to-work mandates have been one of the most divisive issues in corporate America, and these companies are going to increase these days, and they eventually want to get to like 85 to 100%. I'm still stunned that companies are getting pushback, and you know, and I'm going to sound like an old guy now, but back in the day, hey, how about we'll find someone else to fill your position then? I cannot believe that we're still talking about this.
Well, when's the last? It's a bit like an entitlement, if you think of it in terms of, you know, when's the last time the government gave something and then took it back?
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't happen.
Interesting. Yeah,
and people are used to that. You know, people are all of a sudden, it was like, well, what do you mean I can't go to work? Okay, let's see if we can pivot. All right. Oh, I kind of like this. Oh, you know what? I kind of like it a lot. Now I'm used to it. And now, what do you mean? What do you mean the race is over and the caution flag has been? What do you mean I got to go back? No. And so, yeah, everybody I know who runs a business is dealing with that. And again, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush because I think you're right. You know, in fact, years ago, I read a book called Rowe, my last name, R-O-W-E.
I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah. It stood for Results-Oriented Work Environment. And it was basically, a manifesto to allow people to work from home or some hybrid schedule. And I was always down for that. In my line of work, it does make sense. But I get your point. You know, the idea that today millions of people are clutching their pearls and saying, how could you? How could you ask me to come back to the office? Yeah, you can file that under expectations/work ethic. And all I can tell you in response is that we got a work ethic curriculum finally into high schools and a couple of colleges. We're at 38 schools so far. And, we haven't really leaned into it hard yet, but I'm going to this year because it's an important piece of the puzzle. You know, you can't just talk about the availability of opportunity or the rosy path that mastering a skill will take you on unless you make some sort of persuasive case for the value of showing up, not just showing up, showing up early and staying late. And taking a bite of the crap sandwich when it's your turn. You know, people don't want to hear this.
Yeah.
And when you make that case for the betterment of the individual, what will always come back over the net is, you're just in the pocket of some rapacious capitalist, or you're just making the employer's case, or you're just painting with too broad a brush and calling everybody lazy. Well, I'm not doing any of that. I'm just saying that work ethic is a choice. And in life, you got two columns, You know, there's a bunch in column A. There's stuff you can't control: your hair color, your skin color, your blood type, your star sign, your race, your ethnicity, your gender. Although I understand there's been some chatter about that. Whatever. There's some things you can't control. And then over here in the other column, you've got character, and you've got work ethic, and you've got gratitude, and you've got delayed gratification, and you've got personal responsibility. And nobody wants to hear it,
yeah.
But it doesn't mean those things aren't real, and it doesn't mean they're not choices that anybody can make. And like it or not, that's just the way the world is. And my foundation has tried to support people who are way more interested in column B, people who are willing to make choices, positive choices, and not look at things that are out of their control and say, well, that's why I'm not doing what I'm doing. It's rigged. The system's against me. It's not fair. I stutter. I this, I that. I can't do anything about that. But I can try and assist the people who I believe are singing out of the same hymn book. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah, and you want to find out more about Mike's foundation, it's MikeRowWorks.org. I love how you give back every day. You do great work, and it's always a pleasure to tap your brain and spend some time with you, Mike.
Well, I'm at your disposal, Dave. It doesn't have to just be Labor Day. Let's do it on Valentine's Day or Groundhog's Day or... Yeah, maybe on Halloween.
Let's do that. Let's do that when the next book comes out for your mom. Let's get her on the air.
Sounds good. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.